Primal Mind, Primal Games. Why do we do what we do? In a moment, Paul LeMay joins me. We'll talk about that. It's an amazing research study that he did, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Looking forward to this chat with Paul LeMay, an independent writer, researcher specializing in science, psychology, the political world. Throughout the 1980s, he served as a professional administrator in several of Canada's national-level sport and health promotion programs. At the dawn of the 90s, he not only moved into nonfiction freelance writing, but also took a serious-minded deep dive into his own spiritual life. Paul never lost his interest in science, especially quantum physics and all things pertaining to the science of the mind. His latest book, Primal Mind, Primal Games, Why We Do What We Do. One of his others was Primal Mind, Primal Games, Dawn Breaks Over Armageddon. Paul, welcome to the program. Looking forward to this.
Wow, thank you. I'm looking forward to it as well.
I'm going to try to pronounce the name of your co-author. Tell me if I'm right. Ready?
Go for it.
Hivzaja Bajramovic.
Well, not too bad. In Eastern Europe, the J's are Y's. So Bajramovic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Who is he? Tell me about him.
Okay. Well, he's a psychiatrist. He was born and raised in Bosnia back in the 40s, grew up in the 30s and 40s, and emigrated to Canada in the early 70s, before any of the Bosnian conflict. And he had already been a doctor over there, and then he had to get recertified in Canada. And he eventually made his way into psychiatry. He went into a teaching hospital ultimately and served there for 30 years, was on the faculty of the University of Ottawa School of Medicine. And during his tenure as a outpatient psychiatrist, he developed a theory that on victimization, which is kind of what we're going to talk about, part of it anyways, tonight.
Interesting. Is he still with us?
He is. He's getting up there in years.
Is he? Okay. Well, it's a fascinating subject. Tell me about the cover. The cover tells you just about everything you need to know about what we're going to talk about tonight. Is that a chimpanzee or a gorilla?
That's a chimpanzee. In fact, it's a National Geographic picture of a chimpanzee that was taken in the wild in the very same jungle, an area of the jungle in Tanzania where Jane Goodall did her research.
Uh-huh. Okay. And this chimpanzee is sitting like he's playing a game of chess with somebody.
That's right.
And he looks like he's doing a good job, by the way.
Well, you know, that board, we took pains to do a little bit of, in some movies, how they sometimes embed little symbolic scenes.
Yeah.
And they're waiting for you to decode it. Well, we did the same thing with the chessboard. And I'm not going to give it away. I just let people look at it and say, okay, what's this chessboard setting up all about?
Try to figure it out. That's cool. I love it.
It's from a Bobby Fischer game.
With Boris Spassky?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
It's a classic game.
Those were one of the best.
Yes.
I remember that. That's what got me interested in chess when I was in my teens.
Oh, yes.
When that happened. Anyway, let's get into this incredible story here. First and foremost, the title, Primal Mind, Primal Games. Explain that for us.
Well, that was something that we were trying to find a terminology that captured in a more experiential way what the victimization theory was about. Now, initially, Hivzaja came up with the idea of just wanting to do a book on victimization process. And we talked about it, and, you know, it's not a term. It's, you know, after a long day's work, people come home from work. They don't want to crack open a book about victimization when they feel like victims most of the day.
All day anyway. That's right.
Yeah, it's not an inspiring read. So we said, no, we've got to take this book and bring it into the lives of people where it's relevant. So we all know, there's the old adage that when you're in a career, you're playing the game, right? We're not just in a rat race, but we're playing a game, and you have to know how to play the game. So that was kind of the core inspiration around the idea about primal. A primal game, which is essentially central to the nature of the human existence, and you can't really escape it. So then it becomes a question, well, how does this game work? And, you know, like chess, it's very complex. But in our case, we instead of having, well, there are always a multiplicity of pieces, but in this particular case, there are three primary mindsets that are involved in how the human mind is set up. So that was, because we saw those, just those three ingredients, like three primary colors, we realized that, okay, we've got to stick to the basics in order to explicate what this is all about.
And those three prime things would be what?
Right. So the terminology that Hibzia came up was fighting mindset, appeasing mindset, and defeated mindset. So these are mindsets that we all have, and they're both adaptive and maladaptive. So the dimensions of fighting is also, it can also be related to assertiveness in the world, mm-hmm. where you're confident, you're self-confident. But where it becomes maladaptive and actually can cause psychopathology is when an individual becomes over-reliant on one particular mindset and uses it too often. And so the same with the other mindsets, it also applies. So that's where he had his major insight. He began to see it through the victimization process with all of the wide range of clients that he was treating, whether it was someone in the military with PTSD or a housewife who had been physically or sexually abused or a child that had been abused. He began to see that these were not disconnected in some thematic way, which, you know, kind of contradicts everything that a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists are trained into, because we have, you know, the DSM, if you're familiar with that book. It's about categories of different kinds of psychopathology, and there are literally hundreds of categories. And there's this idea, you know, well, each particular category has to be treated and diagnosed in a different way. He began to see that that may not be the case, that in fact this could all be boiled down to a very simple formula, and that these three mindsets and the degree to which one was over-reliant and overusing each of these was probably the core reason why the psychopathology would emerge.
Now, let's get into the subtitle, which I think is critical, Why We Do What We Do. That's so important, isn't it, Paul?
Yes, because what we're talking about here is that this programming is largely unconscious. And because it's unconscious, we're not fully empowered with what we do a lot of the time. So that's why we do what we do. So a lot of times we see behaviors in our daily lives where people do stupid things. Like we're driving down the street coming to work and somebody cuts us off with their car. And then we have our reaction.
Our road rage, right?
The road rage thing might kick in. We might be fearful depending on the kind of driver we are. There are a lot kind of possibilities, but it's like we say, you know, just in a cavalier way, we say it's a jungle out there. And in a way, it is true. It is a jungle. It's a concrete jungle. And the fact that we rely on those metaphors to try to describe and capture the experiences we're having is actually revelatory about really what we're going through in a psychological sense. So why we do what we do is a lot of times dictated by these reactions. And, you know, when you get into spiritual practices, whatever they may be, in Buddhism, for example, when you have these meditative practices, some of the things that you get taught is that you need to step back from your initial reactions and to just look, you know, become a neutral observer of your own behavioral tendencies at times so that you can at least see them rather than just become this, you know, a reactive animal like a rat in a maze. You want to have an ability to look at what is the most appropriate response in a given situation, and that takes a certain amount of distancing. That's actually, it's called that, distancing. So perspective taking, and then you're not a reactive animal, you're a thinking human being.
Does your work allow you to pinpoint the differences between, let's say, two people and how they function, how they work in society, and why they do the way they do it?
Yep. Yes. And Hibzia developed a questionnaire. And the there are certain questions that can actually reveal, you know, as a pattern, like this questionnaire we have on our website, for example. It's a freebie. There are 108 questions, and the tendencies that we use in the answers we have to certain questions kind of pinpoints the tendency that a person will have in the way they are programmed, let's call it that. Now, I don't want to just give the impression that we're programmed that way, like as though we went to school and this got ingrained into our thinking. What really was going on is that there is an actual biological imprint that's pre-existent. It might be genetically determined. It's a debatable question in science. There may be some influences for sure with conditioning histories, you know, socialization. But by and large, this is a kind of an ingrained thing. And when child psychologists, developmental psychologists in the 1950s and 60s dug into the topic of human temperament, Chess, Thomas, and Birch, they found a very similar structure. Like I mentioned, the three mindsets of fighting, appeasing, and defeated. They found a very, very similar pattern in children. They likened the appeasing mindset to easy. They likened the fighting mindset to difficult, and they likened what we would call the defeated mindset to slow to warm, so the shy child. So these behaviors were seen in about 141 kids that were followed in a longitudinal study that lasted almost 10 years. So that was a really great insight into just how deeply implanted these temperamental tendencies are. And by the way, George, I think it's important to mention that it's not like we belong to one of those three silos of behavior exclusively. They found that in the children, for example, that the vast majority of people, and that's like in the order of 60%+, mm-hmm. were in what we would call the appeasing mindset, but what they would call the easy. So remember, there's an adaptive functional side to being diplomatic and being cooperative and all that. So when you look at these behaviors, the psychologists also found that there were children who actually displayed all three temperaments.
I was going to say, do we include all three in just about every personality?
Every person has all three. You can't, because when you dig down deeper into this topic, we began to see that this is actually related to what's called the fight, flight, and freeze instinct.
Right.
So that instinct, which was discovered by a Harvard physiologist named Walter Cannon back in 1915, they found that these kinds of instinctual reactions occurred in much more primitive animals, be they rats, mice, and whatever. And so the premise that we began to see that this architecture is a byproduct of the evolutionary history of the human species and maybe even the animal species on planet Earth. So you could see the fighting mindset is an outgrowth of the fight instinct. Of course, much more elaborated because we have a much larger brain. Similarly, with the flight instinct, flight is actually aversion, and aversion is related to defeated, even though that doesn't sound like anything. But if you were an animal, the end product of your flight from a dangerous situation would probably be to seek refuge in like a cave or in a bush and to hide, right? So that's like taking umbrage. That's that withdrawal from interacting with the environment. You're going into a place of safety, just like an animal that has a shell, like a turtle, right? It'll exactly. withdraw into its shell. And so the freeze instinct, ironically, though it seems to have a bad name, it actually had an interesting property. It became... You sometimes see this. I don't know if you've ever been driving down the highway and you see a deer that went about to cross the highway in front of you.
And they freeze on you.
Night, yeah. And it'll freeze. So when it's freezing, what it's going on is not just petrified with fear. What it's doing is it's actually assessing what actions to take.
And what's coming at me.
Yeah. It's looking. Is the danger coming at me, and how do I avoid it? So if it's a, you know, a bear that wants to attack it and eat it, it wants to know. It's like in martial arts, right? If someone is going to throw a punch, the best thing you can do is to watch how the punch is being thrown, and then you avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
So similarly, the same process occurs in an animal. The animal is effectively freezing just in a very temporary way in order to determine what move you're going to make. So when you commit to that move, you will take a counter move in order to evade.
Well, you brought up something interesting, because in most cases, that deer will then jump out of the way. In some cases, it'll stay there looking at you and get hit.
Yeah.
What causes like that?
What causes that?
Is that like the defeated mindset, where it just basically gives up? I mean,
it's possible. It's possible. It's hard to know. You know, it's hard to kind of read into what an animal is thinking in a moment like that. But what in an evolutionary sense with humans, what happened, and this is what some of the things that Jane Goodall saw in her research in the jungle with wild chimps and monkeys generally, all the primates, they spend a lot of time in the trees and they look at what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just like humans when they go to a bar.
They have nothing else to do, right?
you're people watching, right? And so the people watching skill set is one where we are learning about what others are doing in order to kind of simulate how we might respond to those kinds of situations. In fact, you could say that television watching is very similar to sitting up in the trees and watching other people, you know, fascinated, voyeurism, just to see what's going on. So this freeze instinct over time elaborated and complexified into what we would today call observant thinking. And as that grew, that capacity within us to stop, watch, and learn became much more prominent. So instead of just fight and flighting, we became a conceptual animal. And it was thanks to the freeze instinct that made that possible.
Does the example that you used in your original book, A Few Good Men, which is a great movie with Jack Nicholson.
Oh, I love that movie.
And, Cuba Gooding, was he in that one too?
Cuba Gooding, I don't think so, no.
He was not that one. There was one
quite a good task.
There was one that he was in where he was a Navy diver. Wonder what
yes.
the name of that one was.
Yes.
But anyways... Tell me about the example with Nicholson. We're coming up to a break, but let's talk now, and then we'll talk it when we come back. You use that movie as an example of these three mindsets.
That's one of the three. It was a great example for the fighting mindset. Anybody who's familiar with that film, you know, the famous line, "You can't handle the truth."
Mm-hmm.
That's a man. That character was so well written. I think Aaron Sorkin, the guy who did the show on the president, U.S. president for many years. In any case, that line typifies the mentality of a fighting mindset person, because they really understand. They might have a very crystal clear idea about what's required in a given situation, and if the other person doesn't and can't tolerate it, they just say, you know what, tough beans. You're going to have to, you know, shape up or ship out. And really, that's kind of the backstory of that whole film, because it was actually based apparently on a true story, you know, of what actually happened in the Marine Corps. So, you know, these kinds of the metaphors in the movies, as this one was, it really reveals the psychology of how someone who is in the fighting mindset gets locked into a given role. And if you remember the movie with the Tom Cruise character, who played Lieutenant Caffey,
yes.
in the courtroom, they baited Nicholson into admitting to ordering.
And they got him upset. We're going to come back and talk more with you, Paul. And, of course, the Men of Honor. That was the name of the movie that Cuba Gooding was in. That was a classic, too. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Paul LeMay, the book Primal Mind, Primal Games. Paul, what is the message that you would love every reader to take away when they read the book?
Wow. Well, there are two books, right? One is dealing with the personal aspect, and the second one was dealing with the social implications
mm-hmm.
of this model. So I think the main message is that people should recognize that there's a lot more to the animal side of our nature than we are normally prepared to give credence to. Generally speaking, a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people find it acceptable to consider the evolutionary theory that we were, the descendants of apes. We can get into that some if you want. But in any case, we have this nature within us that is always tugging at our shirt sleeves, always demanding that's the agenda that it wants to fulfill. And as a result, we find ourselves responding to others in a manner which is often a very competitive mindset. In the jungle, for example, with chimpanzees, there's a very strong social hierarchy, a pecking order, which is enforced with violence. We have probably gone beyond that in many ways, of course, but we're still seeing some of the vestiges of that when you have a boss who berates a subordinate employee, for example. That's an example of the alpha male tendency to dominate another animal. So when people are in that position of having to be stressed out by those situations, it helps to contextualize what the heck is going on from the point of view of that evolutionary psychology and saying, that guy doesn't really realize, or that woman, depending on the gender of one's boss, that person doesn't really see what they're doing. They're not conscious to their own, how this nature is dictating their behavior. And if you in a calm moment, whether you're having a beer with somebody, you could actually have that conversation and they would go, yeah, you know what? I didn't realize I did that. And that's one of the things I think our culture, despite all of the New Age movement and self-help books, I don't think we're doing a great job in the psychological literacy area for our population at large. We've all caught, through the cultural media, if you can call it that, certain terminologies that people like to throw around, like PTSD. Most people know what that means. Neurosis and ego and a whole vocabulary that's come down to us over the century. But really, we don't spend a lot of time talking about the animal psychology component of our behavior. And I think we would do well to pay a little bit more attention to that, because it really is dictating a lot of the cultural norms that we just assume are normal parts of life in this modern world, whereas instead of being vestiges of a time literally a million years ago or more that we're still carrying with us as a form of baggage that's deeply ingrained in us.
Of these three mindsets, fighting, appeasing, or defeated, is there any one of the three that most people should have?
I would say that, when we say appeasing, of course, the term has a really condescending implication, right?
Of backing down, right?
Of backing down, of being overly diplomatic, right? And in the face of a bully, sometimes that behavior response is not an appropriate one. We always say that if you want to, the best way to deal with the bully is to stand up to the bully.
That's right. That would be the fighting mindset.
That's the fighting mindset. So being assertive does play an adaptive role in some situations, and especially if that person is all about power. If the person is focused on maintaining power and controlling power, they have to understand, they recognize that they're in an environment where power is being used, and when they meet another person who is equally powerful, they tend to moderate their behavior and become, in a sense, appeasers. They become more, like colleagues, like famous boxers often became friends after they were in the ring together, right? So, but there's a fourth dimension to this, I think, that's important to mention, George, is that these three mindsets are not just silos. There is a bleeding over or blending of them, because our brain doesn't just operate in these three silos.
You could have any three at any moment, right?
You can. and because there's an integrating function. When we did a little bit of background research into the brain and how it's structured to see if we could find brain structures that replicate these various mindsets, we found a really, really important one called the cingulate cortex. Now, for those people who know a little bit about the brain, there's a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere, and we often talk about that, right? Left brain people and right brain people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just that simple. There is another component to the brain, which is the corpus callosum is this brain structure that actually connects the left and the right hemisphere. And just sitting above that corpus callosum is the structure called the cingulate cortex. That structure is the integrator, the integrating function of our brain. If we didn't have that, George, we would walk around like with people like with multiple personality disorder. You would have a fighter in your head, you would have an appeaser in your head, and you'd have a defeated person in your head, and each one wouldn't know what the other one was doing. And we all know that that's a very unusual condition that does exist in psychiatry, but generally speaking, most people have some balance between all of those mindsets, and it's the integrating function which is really key to us developing a spiritual awareness. That structure demonstrates that this system of ours is intended to work as a complex system where we can draw on skills in the various mindsets and combine them into new combinations, into new nuanced color combinations, which allows us to adapt, and that's what makes us adaptable creatures.
Where would you categorize, Paul, most successful people under these mindsets? What trait would they use most of the time?
That, George, depends on your definition of successful.
True.
If you mean materially successful, generally speaking, they would probably be dominant in the fighting mindset.
Okay.
Only about 12% of the people are likely in the fighting mindset as a dominant feature.
At any given time?
Let's just say if there was a dominant central characteristic that a person referred to as their way of identifying themselves, right? They'd say, well, I'm a very confident business person or athlete or whatever. And we all know such people. They wouldn't necessarily call themselves fighters, although they might. They would have that go get them attitude. The appeaser, which probably constitutes about, based on the research we've seen, about 66 to 67% of the general population. And it's a good thing that's the case, because if we had a society completely full of fighters, well, it wouldn't have survived. And as far as defeated is concerned, although that too has this implication of being something that's, you know, a person who's become in a helpless state, curled up in a corner, it's not entirely like that. People who withdraw, you know, like the spiritual types that will withdraw to the cave or go to the mountain and seek isolation in order to connect with the larger universe, they're effectively doing that. They're trying to get in tune with another. So is that a measure of success? It might be.
Could be.
Diplomatic, another measure of success, it might be too. So, again, success is a relative term.
What about telepathy? Where does that fit into any of this?
Okay. Now we're going to get into something interesting here. This comes back to the brain a little bit, not just the brain, but the rest of the body. Okay, so I'll just mention one thing here. Our brain has about 86 billion gray matter neurons.
86 billion?
86 billion.
Jeez.
And this is one of the things, this is the next part that most people don't know. We also have about 84 billion white matter glial cells. Now, most people go, what? What's that?
What are they?
Well,
yeah.
That the difference between the two is stark. This brain science is an emergent area of brain science that's been really big, ramping up in the last 10 years or so. The key difference between these two systems in our brain, we basically have two brains in our brain. The neurons are basically action potential systems, which means they're all or nothing firing systems like a binary computer with an on-off switch, and they're responsible for initiating our reactions. A lot of conventional brain scientists seem to think that thinking happens in the gray matter. This new view of the glial cell would challenge that view and say, no, neurons are merely the handmaidens of the glial cell system. Glial cells, unlike neurons in their action potential firing, it's an electrochemical system. As we heard, you know, your earlier speaker about 5G and whatever.
Yeah.
It's an electrically potentiated system. Whereas glial cells operate on a system called calcium signaling, which uses, effectively, it makes the brain a wireless system in addition to this electrical system. So it can communicate wirelessly through calcium signaling to the various parts of the brain. Now, when we come to telepathy, where does that fit into the story? This is going to go to another level, even deeper than those two aspects of the brain that I mentioned. This comes down to the area of structures of biomolecules, both in DNA. You know what the base pairs are? If you looked at the structure of the base pairs in DNA, they look like little hexagons and pentagons.
Right.
Those are called indole rings or aromatic rings. The same thing exists in four major amino acids in our body. Now, this is down way below the nanoscale level. This goes down to this picometer scale. So in the DNA, each DNA strand has 3 billion base pairs in a single strand in each cell of our body. And we have over a trillion, 2 trillion, 3 trillion cells, depending on your age. And that represents these little guys, these little indole rings, represent photon processors. They're holders of photonic fields above and below the plane of the molecule. So why is that important? Because photonic information is essentially ingested by our biology when we go out into the day and the sun is shining. We're absorbing photonic energy and information, by the way, with that energy. And in the research that Fritz Albert Popp had conducted around biophotons, we are also likely emitting energy. So the question is, where is that energy coming from? How in heck are we emitting energy? And then, you know, he found potatoes were emitting energy.
And is it supernatural or is it biological?
Well, this is the part where science begins to break down, because then we're getting into an area where science has no real answer here, but we have philosophies that would suggest that our souls are emanating light. Right? We're literally giving off light. When Jesus had the transfiguration, it wasn't because he was sunbathing. It was because he had achieved a state of consciousness which allowed for that illumination experience. So the question then, George, becomes is, what mechanism in the body would allow a soul to interface with a biological entity that we call our human body? And it has to be a mechanism that would allow for light to be harvested and used as information and energy, both life energy. So these little critters, these little aromatic rings, whether they're hexagons or pentagons, they are the best candidates, biological candidates, for holding quantum information above and below the plane of the molecule. And that is the basis of where we could possibly have entanglement experiences, and that would explain, it becomes a candidate explanation for how telepathy is possible, how remote viewing is possible.
Remote viewing, sure.
A lot of
telekinesis.
Telekinesis is possible. I went to one of the conferences that Stuart Hameroff had back in Tucson in 2012, and I remember one of the presenters was talking about telepathy, and she actually said, we know of no known biological mechanism in the human body that could explain telepathy. And I, at the moment she said that, I stood up and said, no, I have one. And we have since been communicating, you know, and she's now at the IONS facility north of San Francisco. So it's really interesting. Mainstream science certainly in the cognitive sciences, hasn't even touched, hasn't even scratched the surface of that issue yet, because it's at another, it's at a wholly different level of investigation.
Let's talk a little bit more about this, Paul, when we come back. Plus, we'll have an hour of phone calls with you. Primal Mind, Primal Games, why we do what we do.